Touchscreen laptops, smart speakers, or high-tech watches. What will you get your gadget lover this holiday season? We'll get you up to speed on all the tech gifts so you don't end up like Arnold Schwarzenegger looking for the latest Turbo Man.
Oh, excuse me.
Yes?
I'm trying to find the Turbo Man doll.
Me too.
Do you have any more in the back?
But first, if you live in Illinois, then you know State Farm is actually your neighbor.
Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
We'll see how the Bloomington-based business is doing this year. Plus, we'll talk to two experts about climate change and the effect that burning fossil fuels is having on the environment. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline and for Nyla Boodoo today. If you live in Illinois, there's a good chance State Farm is part of your life one way or another, whether it's car insurance, homeowners insurance, or jobs, especially for people living near their Bloomington headquarters. State Farm insures the most homes and cars in Illinois by far, and next year they're set to raise rates for homeowners insurance by nearly 4%. That's the biggest increase in 4 years. State Farm and the other largest auto insurance companies also raised rates for cars these past few years. Joining me on the line from Chicago is Steve Daniels. He's a senior reporter with Cranes, who recently wrote about State Farm. And Charlie Schlenker is also on the line from Normal, where the company is based. He's the news director of WGLT Public Radio. Charlie and Steve, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And Steve, let's start with you. Starting with homeowners insurance, how big is State Farm's presence in the state in terms of insuring homes?
Well, it's enormous. It's enormous both in cars and homes. It insures about one of every three homes in the state, and likewise one about of every three vehicles in the state.
And you wrote about this in Cranes last week, but State Farm's rates had been pretty flat these past few years. But for homeowners insurance, they're raising rates by nearly 4%. What's behind that increase?
Well, it's the usual in terms of what insurance companies say when they raise rates, which is that we're seeing higher claims costs. We're seeing things happen that force us to raise prices. In the case of Illinois, you can actually look at those numbers, and in State Farm's case, that doesn't appear to be true at least through last year, but we don't have numbers for 2017, so maybe there are things happening in 2017 that will explain this next year.
Okay. Charlie, over to you. There have been a lot of natural disasters in the news lately, whether that's hurricanes in Texas, Florida, Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, or the wildfires in California and the Pacific Northwest. Has State Farm had an unusually large amount of claims this year because of that?
Yeah. But that is, over the long haul is goes up and goes down, and they tend to think with a long picture. It has been a bad year for so-called catastrophes, and there's one other category that you should probably toss in there too: hailstorms. Those are tremendously bad for their auto side of the business.
Okay. And Steve, what role did those natural disasters play in setting insurance rates? I know you pointed out in your piece that companies aren't supposed to raise rates in areas that aren't affected by unusual activity. So, you know, if there's been hurricanes in other parts of the country, that shouldn't necessarily affect homeowners insurance rates people may pay in Illinois. But how does this all work?
Well, you know, it's a little bit of a black box. There are indeed, you know, insurance is a state-by-state regulated business, and Illinois is probably the lightest regulator of insurance companies in the nation in terms of what they do with their rates. Illinois really has for many decades had the opinion and the attitude that market forces will control those sorts of things, and if customers don't like what their insurance company is doing, they'll go find another one. There are quite a lot of people who really don't follow their insurance rates very closely, unless they go up dramatically. So there are questions about what insurers are doing in Illinois in terms of raising their rates, and more so on auto than home side, versus what they're doing in the rest of the country. It's easier if you don't have a regulator looking over your shoulder and having to approve the rates that you have, it's easier to raise them, obviously. And so there are some questions about whether the path of least resistance in Illinois are enabling our largest insurers to raise rates faster than in other parts of the country.
And Steve, you know, Illinois is the only state that doesn't regulate auto insurance rates. So what's the history behind that?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I can't give you chapter and verse on it, but needless to say, we have the two of the largest personal lines insurers in the country based in the state, in State Farm and Allstate, and so, you know, that's a tremendous economic boon in some respects. Obviously, down in the Bloomington area, State Farm's a huge employer and a really important economic force. You know, up here in Northbrook, Allstate also is a big employer, and for many years, the state has had a hands-off approach on rates, and you know, and can point to a lot of competition here. There's a lot of insurers, there are a lot of choices, so it really is a kind of a philosophical difference.
Sure, and one more for you here, Steve, before we go back to Charlie. But how is State Farm doing generally compared with some of its competitors, like say Allstate, Progressive, Geico?
Right. Well, State Farm is in 2016. State Farm suffered their worst auto insurance losses ever in their 95-year history. You know, the auto business in particular has been hard hit by claims in recent years, distracted driving, just more as the economy picked up, more people on the roads, and it, all insurers, not just State Farm, really scrambled to try to catch up with that in terms of their rates. But even though that was a multi-billion-dollar loss just in the auto line, in other parts of their business, they made enough money so that they eked out a tiny profit. Essentially, you can call it a break-even year, you know, on their investments. Certainly, their homeowners has been profitable. So, you know, State Farm is just an enormous company. They generally speaking, you know, they're a mutual, which means that they're owned by their policyholders and not by outside investors. So they don't have the same kind of profit motives that, say, an Allstate does, which has to please its investors. So over the years, State Farm has, you know, made a fair amount of money in some years, and in other years, not so much. And they really just kind of look to keep themselves financially healthy in order to pay claims from their enormous customer count.
And over the long haul, they've been quite healthy. They finished the year at about $87-88 billion. That's roughly double what it was just after the Great Recession, and even more than doubled from 2001. So they've a lot of that is the run-up in the stock market, but that's why they keep this huge portfolio of investments, so that they can absorb what they absorbed last year, which was a $5.5 billion loss on underwriting.
And Charlie, I'd like to ask you about jobs here. State Farm employs about 15,000 people in the Bloomington-Normal area, where the headquarters is. What kind of jobs are we talking about here?
We're talking about a wide variety of jobs, from basic jobs to fairly highly paid jobs. The company has been fairly steady following a digital reinvention a few years ago, at which the number dropped from about 19,000 to 15,000, and they committed after some dark time of not telling the community what was going on to maintaining it at about 15,000. Whether those jobs are going to stay high quality jobs is an open question. It's a little bit nibbling around the margins. For instance, they recently announced that they're going to or are in the middle of sending some of their IT positions away from Bloomington and to the new hub system that they've constructed over the last several years in Dallas, Atlanta, Phoenix, and so forth. So one would assume that those are higher paying jobs than average, so the average may go down a little bit, but the overall number should stay steady at about 15,000.
Okay, and back in May,
and I would add one thing on in terms of jobs at State Farm up in the Chicago area. On a negative side, they are closing suburban Downers Grove office that employs 460 people over the next 4 years. They did shuffle the decks some in terms of their offices nationwide, and that's a pretty substantial employment loss out in the western burbs.
And in a number of states, too, they're moving to this hub system from a regional system to gain efficiencies and to take advantage of the internet and the infotech that allows them to concentrate and have fewer bricks and mortar places.
Yeah, if you could maybe expand a little bit more on this hub system, Charlie. You were talking about, you know, these different hubs in, say, Dallas, Atlanta. How is this all working for State Farm?
So far, so good. There have been signs that they are having to compete harder to get the people they want in these larger metro areas where there is competition for quality jobs, where there are other large companies that people can go to across town without moving themselves. So that has required them to adjust their transfer policies. It's required them to change the way they offer some benefits. And I think it is changing their thinking in the way that they consider the life cycle of an employee. It used to be you got a job at State Farm and you were shepherded around the country at various points in your career, but you were always with State Farm because State Farm had these hubs where they were, or had these regional offices where they were the biggest game in town. And of course, in Bloomington Normal, they're the biggest game in town by far. So you stayed with State Farm. That may no longer be the case.
And certainly, Charlie, you know, we talked a little bit about how well it's working for them. But if you could just explain what this is exactly, how is this changing things for State Farm?
It's allowing them to have more centrally located informational technologies. It's allowing them to use the internet to have efficiencies. So they may have reduced their overall workforce slightly by transferring from the regions to the hubs. They're certainly updating their technology, and that was a big reason for it. For years, State Farm was at a structural disadvantage compared to places like GEICO, which were solely on the internet because they had so much invested in customer service at the agency level, and the regional levels serve the agents. Now they can gain some economies of scale by having hubs in larger parts of the country.
Okay. And certainly a big story earlier this year was Caterpillar, another huge Illinois business, moving their headquarters from Peoria to Deerfield, just north of Chicago. But as far as you can tell, State Farm has said that they're staying put in Bloomington for the foreseeable future. Is that right?
That's what they're saying. There's still some anxiety about that among local community leaders because of the way State Farm handled its initial hub system change and the several thousand IT workers that they brought in as temporary workers, many of them contractors and not direct employees. When those went away, the community was affected, and State Farm didn't pony up with the information right away, and that caused a lot of anxiety, and the anxiety lingers because you tend to wonder if there is an ongoing commitment to the community. So far, State Farm, according to Labor Department numbers, is meeting that commitment.
And Steve, bringing you back in here, let's talk a little bit more about auto insurance. Back in September, you wrote about auto insurance rates. They've been going up at a much faster rate than homeowners, not only for people who have State Farm, but also other companies like Allstate and GEICO. What's behind those increases?
Well, what's been behind it was, for the last couple of years, a sharp increase for insurance companies in the claims they were paying out. There were a number of reasons for it. Some of it had to do with increases in health care costs and auto repairs as vehicles get more sophisticated, but more of it was just more accidents, and distracted driving was a major culprit that insurers identified. Also, just like I said before, more cars on the road, people driving to work as more people were employed. So those sorts of sharp increases in accidents seem to have leveled off this year. And yet we're still seeing, you know, maybe not as dramatic increases, but we're still seeing increases in rates. So there's some question as to, you know, I think we're seeing regulators, even in Illinois, the Rauner administration has discussed looking into trying to do something to level off the auto price or the auto insurance increases. So we'll see what comes in there. I think 2018 may be an interesting year on that.
Yeah, and quickly, one more for you here, Steve. You know, someone who's written a lot about insurance, you know, people might not pay attention unless their rates really go up drastically. But what are some things that people should understand about homeowners insurance and auto insurance when they see news stories about it?
Well, I think that people always, I think complacency is a real issue for a lot of customers. You know, if they've been with their insurance company for a long time, clearly there are insurance companies who, and pricing in the industry has gotten way more sophisticated. So clearly there are companies who kind of have decided or have even some formulas for determining which customers are likely to shop and which are not. And if you're one of the ones who are not, you're going to get higher increases. So it really even rattling the cage a little bit and going to your agent if you have a homeowner's policy, probably you're with Allstate or State Farm because Geico really doesn't offer homeowners. You know, going to your agent saying things are looking a little high here. You know, I might need to shop around and see what happens at the very least. But certainly, okay, People have noticed the auto increases.
Sure, definitely. We'll have to leave it there, guys. But Steve Daniels, senior reporter at Crane Chicago, Charlie Schlenker, the news director at WGLT in Bloomington Normal. Steve and Charlie, thanks to both of you for joining us on the 21st.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo today. Everyone has heard the words fossil fuels, carbon dioxide, and global warming, but how many of us really know how it all works? Every year, scientists around the world work on something called the Global Carbon Budget. It measures just how much carbon dioxide, or CO2, we're pumping into the atmosphere. And this time, they found that global CO2 emissions from burning fossil fuels are on the rise again after 3 years of stability. To help us understand all this information and what it could mean for the future of climate change, we're joined by Atul Jain. Jain is a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Illinois. Professor Jain also contributed to the Global Carbon Budget. We're also joined on the line by Karen Weigert, senior fellow on global cities from the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Atul and Karen, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much.
And Atul, let's start with you. As we mentioned, you contributed data to the Global Carbon Budget. This is where scientists are measuring just how much carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere and where it's being distributed. Why is this important?
Okay, so let me give you a little bit brief, actually, information about this report. And this report published in International Journal of Earth System Science Data, co-authored by about 77 scientists from about 57 organizations in 15 countries. And this report provides the estimates of the global carbon budget for year 2007. Although the title states about 2017, but the report includes estimates of the budget for last 250 years, starting the pre-industrial revolution time, the time before the fossil fuel burning era. So this report provides an accurate annual, decadal, century timescale assessment of anthropogenic carbon dioxide emissions that includes the fossil burning and the emissions from the land cover land use change, that is the deforestation, and how these total emissions are distributed or redistributed among the atmosphere, ocean, and the terrestrial biosphere.
Okay. So this is specifically emissions from burning fossil fuels. They're up this year after 3 years of being flat. Why were those emissions flat for the last 3 years, and now why are they on the rise?
Okay, so first of all, I should emphasize here, although the most of the time the emphasis go on to this fossil burning, but this report, as I have mentioned, also include the emissions from the deforestation.
Okay.
And also the other two components. So it's all the in terms of the CO2 emissions, all about the energy. In the past 3 years, what we have noticed that the emissions were actually not increasing, but in this year, the emissions, as you have mentioned in the beginning of your show, that we see the rise, and actually the rise is only about 2%, and it's mainly because of the major, the CO2 emission polluters, for example, China. So the most significant contribution factor for this year emission increase is, the emissions coming from higher emissions from China. In fact, China was the major factor which actually had a much lower emission in the past 3 years. Because of that, the emissions were not increasing, including in the U.S. too. Also, the emissions were declining. And for example, the last 2 years, the emissions in the U.S. declined about 2.5% per year. And in the case of China this year, the increase is about 3.5%. And also in case of U.S., the increase is about 0.04%, which is much, much lower than the past years. So the decrease is only about 0.4% in the U.S., which is much, much lower than the decrease in the past few years in the U.S., which is about 2.5%.
Okay. Karen, I'd like to bring you in the conversation here. We know that climate change is happening on a large scale, and we're hearing from Atul that there are more emissions worldwide right now. Before you were with the Chicago Council, you were also the Chief Sustainability Officer for the City of Chicago. How does the carbon dioxide that goes into the atmosphere affect day-to-day life, especially in a large city like Chicago?
Well, Chicago is positioned in a really unique way, which is the city, for a long time now, has actually looked at where its emissions come from, and then what are the kinds of solutions that can reduce those emissions and make life better day-to-day. So to be specific about that, in a city like Chicago, the majority of emissions come from buildings and manufacturing. It's heating, cooling, and operating buildings. And that's about 70%+. And then the next big source is transportation. So the city has been working explicitly on trying to reduce the energy used in buildings and then to source that energy more renewably. And at the same time, the city has been building out more transportation options, so strengthening the train lines, adding more biking opportunities, thinking about parks and playgrounds that are walkable in neighborhoods. All of those things create a great place to live, and when you're doing a great amount of work on efficiency, et cetera, you're actually creating jobs. Now, that's the plus side of reducing emissions. The challenge is, as we've talked about here, emissions globally have risen over many years, although they actually are down in Chicago over the last few years. And that's caused changes in the weather that we experience day to day. So when you think about it here in Chicago and in many places across Illinois, the weather is different. And some of those extremes are things like we have more high-intensity rain events. So a whole lot of rain falls in a very short period of time. Where does it go? We experience flooding literally in the city of Chicago. Or more of those high heat days, those dangerous days when temperatures are too high for many of our residents, particularly our more vulnerable residents. And so those are also things that the city of Chicago and other places are working on. So how do you handle storms and water and handle the actual processing and the movement of that water through things like green infrastructure or plants or building bigger infrastructure underneath the ground? And then how do you make sure that residents are safe on those high heat days? And that can be things like white roofs that reflect the sun, or in many, many neighborhoods in Chicago, opening cooling centers so people have a place to go if they don't have air conditioning at home. So it's a huge combination of thinking about where those emissions come from. There's a lot to do there and a lot more to happen. But also, we are seeing those changes. And how can we ensure that our residents are safe today?
And Karen, we've been hearing about climate change for what it seems like a very long time now. Many Americans don't even believe it's real, even though it is a scientific fact. Do you worry that people might tune out this kind of news?
Well, it's interesting. The national story on climate does sound as though there's a lot of controversy. But if you look at the actual polling data of Americans, the majority of Americans do believe that humans are causing these changes in the climate, and they also believe that the U.S. should do something about it. In fact, the majority of Americans support the U.S. staying in the Paris Climate Agreement, which is obviously not the position of the federal government, but it's certainly the position of many states and cities and businesses, as well as many individuals. So what I've been heartened by more than anything has been just the action that is being taken at different levels across the U.S. So what I think we'll see is more and more people are experiencing changes in weather. They're seeing these threats, these supercharged storms that have hit other places of the country when you've had these series of hurricanes. And then they're also seeing opportunities. The creation of more jobs linked to solar or more jobs related to energy efficiency. And so that, I think, will continue to shape this conversation. Americans have a starting point of an understanding and a belief nationally from polls. It's really about how do we make this practical.
And Karen, what would you recommend that we do at the state level about climate change? And can these local decisions really make a dent?
Yeah, I think to your last question, can local decisions make a dent? The short answer is absolutely. Some of it is because carbon is carbon, no matter where it comes from. It all goes into the atmosphere and affects us all. So you can absolutely have that impact there. The majority of emissions globally from fossil fuels are actually linked to people living in cities and in their communities. And the United States is officially 80% urban. So all of those decisions really add up. It's kind of like voting. Every single vote adds up to get to that answer. And so, yes, absolutely more and more action on the ground does accumulate. It also creates examples for other people to follow or tests and data that other people can leverage. And so when you think about it at the state level, you know, there's actually really interesting backdrop now in Illinois, which is energy legislation. It's the Future Energy Jobs Act. And so that is going to open the door for more and more focus and action on efficiency in buildings all across our state. It's going to open the door for more renewables that will power the electricity that we're all using across the state. And in doing those things, we should be creating more and more jobs and opportunities so that more and more people across Illinois can take part in those solutions. Now, at the same time, a lot of climate change decisions will happen around the dining room table. And so it's what can we all do to find the piece that we can do each day to strengthen our city, to strengthen our state, and then broadly to strengthen that next generation, because we're going to be in this challenge for a while.
Atul, bringing you back in here, you've said that it's important to emphasize that we're not just talking about fossil fuels here. There's also other factors, including deforestation. What's the breakdown here? How much of the carbon dioxide we're seeing comes from fossil fuels, and where does the rest come from?
Okay, so globally, about 40 billion metric tons of CO2 is emitted by the human activities. About 89% of actually come from the fossil fuel burning, and about 11% come from due to the deforestation activities. And about 50% of that actually is being absorbed by the terrestrial ecosystem then and the oceans. So the rest 50% remain in the atmosphere. Because this rest 50%, the CO2 concentration is rising. If you really want to control the CO2 in the atmosphere at a stabilized level, that we really need to think about some alternative, the carbon-free energy sources to reduce that 50%. That's the, the budget.
Okay. And research has also suggested that global emissions from human activities will reach about 41 billion tons this year.
So this is the total amount.
Yeah.
Billion amount.
Right. Can you put that number in perspective for us? What does that really mean?
So, for example, if you look at this 41 billion, can you repeat me again the question, actually?
Sure. The number 41 billion tons that we're projected to reach here in 2017 of global CO2 emissions. What does that number really mean? What can you put that in perspective for us?
So in what ways? I mean, if suppose you think about the 41 billion, About, as I said, there's about 36 billion come from the fossil burning, and about 4.7 billion tons come from the fossil, you know, from the deforestation. If you go back and look at the middle of this 20th century, most of the emissions were coming from the deforestation, not from the fossil burning. But because of the, you know, the industrial activities have increased over the time, and that actually increased the fossil burning, and that's why we have a much higher fossil burning now than in the past, actually. So in terms of the CO2 emission, in terms of the CO2 concentrations, about, you know, about 50% in this 20 billion tons is actually every year we are actually emitting in the atmosphere, and that's why the CO2 concentration is rising. Does it make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. And Karen, the Paris Climate Agreement, which you alluded to a little bit earlier, what's the role of that agreement in everything that's been happening specifically in Chicago here recently? Has it made a big difference in some of the city's policies?
Well, the Paris Agreement, which was coming up on about 2 years when it was signed, and since then you've had nations who are the actual signatories making their commitments, and each country got to determine its own. But what you've actually started to see in Chicago has made the choice that it as a city is committing to the original U.S. commitment. So it's absolutely moving into other realms outside of just what the national government is doing. So Chicago has made its own commitment. And the Chicago has announced, as an example, that all city buildings will be powered by renewable energy by 2025 as part of reaching that commitment. And so what's been quite interesting in many ways has been this huge response from different kinds of organizations across the U.S. to the Paris Agreement. There's actually an entire movement called We Are Still In, which is being signed up to by lots of organizations from multiple sectors who are saying we as an organization are committed to Paris and to delivering our part of what the U.S. originally said it would do. So you do see it. And then that translates into real things on the ground that will continue to make life in Chicago strong and ideally continue to bring down the carbon footprint of folks who live here. Already, the city of Chicago per capita has a lower carbon footprint than people who live outside of it. We've got to continue to strengthen that. It's been going down a little bit, but the more we in the city of Chicago and the more communities across Illinois can create those opportunities to reduce emissions, which in a practical terms is less carbon per trip or taking fewer trips. How can you walk somewhere or combine your trips or make sure your vehicle is more efficient? How can you use less energy in the buildings that you're in? Those are the daily choices that build up then to a city like Chicago and other cities committing to the Paris Agreement, and then ultimately to the U.S. role as part of a global agreement, working towards keeping carbon emissions under a limit that will protect global temperatures so that we can have great cities, great communities, great towns for generations to come.
Speaking of global roles, Atul, certainly one reason why that there's more economic activity leading to more emissions is the growth in the economies of China and India. What's their role in all of this?
Okay, so let me a little bit talk about the Paris Agreement. Based on our study, what we find is that the actual decline in global CO2 emissions might still be on our immediate reach, especially given the projections for the strong economic growth in 2018. This suggests that achieving the Paris Agreement, that is to stabilize our climate at well below 2 degrees Celsius of global warming, is going to be challenging. But as Karen suggested, that there are some efforts on a global, you know, on a global scale as well as a country scale. And because of those efforts, the commitments of many countries to make Paris Agreement successful suggest that CO2 emissions may not actually return to the high growth rates experienced in 2000s. And in fact, actually, we have seen the peak in the coal burning around 2014, and we expect actually it not to achieve, go beyond the peak level. However, it remains to be seen if the countries stick to their commitment, in fact, actually. So in terms of the global scale, there are some good spots, there are some bad spots. As I have mentioned, China is the biggest actually CO2 emitter, and it is going to remain the bigger emitter in the coming years.
Okay, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop right there. That's Atul Jain, professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Illinois, Karen Weigert from the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Both of you, thank you so much for joining us on the 21st.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Dan.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline. Thanks for being with us today. The latest and greatest technology often goes fast during the holidays, and this year is no different. Whether you're looking for a Nintendo Switch for the kids or a new touchscreen laptop for mom or dad, the hottest items won't be around for long. If you're still brainstorming gift ideas for friends and family, don't worry. We have you covered. The Chicago Tribune's Blue Sky Innovations section covers interesting tech and startup news from around Illinois. Earlier this month, it put together its own list of gifts for the tech-savvy crowd, like solar-charging backpacks or music-playing pillows. Blue Sky News editor Ben Meyerson is on the line from Chicago to tell us more about the hottest tech gifts for this holiday season. Ben, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, Brian. How you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for being with us today. And if you've got questions for Ben about what to buy, you can just tweet us at 21STShow. Ben, one of the most popular video game systems this year has been the Nintendo Switch. It's been hard to find ever since it came out in March, and it was a big seller during Black Friday this year, too. I understand that it's not exactly a typical video game system. Can you explain exactly what it is again for us?
Yeah, so the Nintendo Switch is kind of a cross between your typical traditional at-home video game system that you plug into your TV and your iPad or something like that. It's a tablet that has controllers that attach to the sides. So you can carry it around with you. You can play it with, like, your Game Boys of old. But when you get home, it has a dock that you can connect to your TV, and you can put the tablet in there, and all of a sudden the games are played on your big screen TV at home there, and you pull the controllers off the side and you have that whole big screen experience. Nintendo has said that despite the fact that it's been very popular and flying off shelves, they're going to have a lot more units this year, so there's a chance you might have some luck getting your hands on it.
Nice. What are some of the other devices that are going fast this holiday season?
Well, every year, without doubt, you've got the new slew of phones that are coming out. Everybody comes out with theirs, it seems, every fall. So Samsung and Apple follow that pattern again this year. And so you've got brand new devices from Samsung. You've got the Galaxy S8 and the Galaxy Note 8, which is, we haven't heard any case of it exploding this year, so that's a good sign. And then, of course, you've got Apple's new phones, the iPhone 10 and the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus.
Okay.
So those are doing pretty well this year.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And there's been kind of an ongoing marketing war, at least to some extent, between Apple and Samsung. Can you bring us up to speed on that?
Yeah, Samsung takes great pleasure, it seems, in throwing stones at Apple and the folks who inevitably wait in line every year for the new device. This year's no different. Samsung's come out with a new marketing campaign saying, oh, Apple's got all these new features. Well, they're not that new. We've had them on our phones for quite some time. So they've got a new ad out there poking fun at it. It's a little bit of a Pepsi and Coke situation. You don't ever see Coke throwing stones at Pepsi, but Pepsi always seems to be throwing a rock at the big guy. So it seems like Samsung has a little bit of an underdog scenario, even though they do tend to sell more phones overall than Apple does.
Interesting. It does seem that technology companies are now putting out more and more upscale, expensive products during the holidays, maybe compared to years past. Have you found that to be the case?
We've had an article on our site for the past week or so talking about this a little bit, about the phenomenon of the various devices that keep increasing in price year over year. This year's iPhones are more expensive than they ever have been before. Now, you can look at the top model here, the iPhone 10, that is bigger and better, actually not physically bigger, but has more features than before. They've got a higher quality screen, you've got fancy facial recognition, but that translates to a price tag that starts over $1,000 before you even up the amount of storage that's with that. The Galaxy Note 8 as well, if you top that one out, it's around $950. You've got fancy Google-powered laptops that start at $1,000 as well, which is significantly over the price of what they used to be. But again, that's the price of some of the newer features you've got on these devices. So it seems like people are shelling out, at least for the iPhones, the iPhone 10 this year. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out long term if these prices of these hot gadgets stay so high.
Any idea on why we're seeing some of these higher price points? They just seem to keep going up and up.
Yeah, really, it seems like it's just the prices of the parts. When you've got this brand new facial recognition technology, not necessarily brand new, but the way that Apple's implemented it, baked into every phone, that seems like it may be one culprit for why the price is a little higher. It also could be the fact that they have a higher quality screen, although, again, it's a technology called OLED, organic LED. So it's got deeper blacks and richer colors. And Apple's got that on the iPhone 10 for the first time here. But again, that's been the type of screen that's been on Samsung's phones for years. In fact, Samsung is supposedly making the screens for the Apple phone, so it's not necessarily an excuse. So it's really just a matter of, do you want the biggest, richest thing? Now, I personally, I bought a new phone this year. I had an iPhone 6 that was getting a little long in the tooth. Battery wasn't doing so great. I opted to go with the iPhone 8 myself, the less expensive model. I didn't feel that I personally needed or wanted to be on the front edge of the Apple line here, waiting several months for a new phone. I felt the iPhone 8, with its still pretty fast processor and higher storage capacity, worked for me. But your mileage may vary. Apple is supposedly doing pretty well, as I said earlier, with the iPhone Xs this year.
Okay.
iPhone Xs, rather.
Yeah. Well, let's get into some specific gift options now. What's one of those things that on your list, maybe to get the dad who has everything?
Yeah, I would say that you look at your dad or even your mom at this point. I know personally when I'm looking at gifts for my dad, it seems like he's got a lot of stuff already. And dads can be so hard to buy for. So what I look for a lot of the time is things that can make dad or mom's life easier. And one of the hottest things this year is the personal assistant. Amazon really jumped into the scene pretty quickly and staked out a really big pretty big space with its Alexa devices, those personal assistants that you put on the counter, and you start and you can talk to it and say, "Hey Alexa, can you set up a calendar appointment for me tomorrow? Hey Alexa, can you play this song on Spotify for me?" But of course, also you can buy stuff off Amazon, which is pretty good for them, I would say. Google seemed to recognize pretty quickly that, oh man, they are really staking out of space here. And they came on hard with their Google Home last year, which did okay, not quite as well as Alexa by many people's measure. So this year, as Amazon has doubled down, adding a device with a screen and a number of other small and large things, Google has come right back with their Google Home Mini, which Google is really laying a marketing on stick for this. They put up a little pop-up shop outside of the Chicago Tribune, which happens to be where I work, where they were giving away donuts or a Google Home. It was kind of a flip a coin type situation. Maybe the odds were a little worse than that, but Google's really putting a push on. They've got ads with Amy Poehler and Nick Offerman of Parks and Recreation fame that are going around. So they seem to be making a pretty hard push to get into this personal assistant game. Again, hot gift this year. Apple said they were going to come out with their personal assistant, a HomePod, by the holidays, but they recently said that that's not going to come out. Now, you could argue back and forth about why that particular device didn't come out for the holidays this year, but it is pretty strange. And again, we've got an article on our website, chicagotribune.com/bluesky, talking about this and why Apple is so far behind in the personal assistant game. They're out of the scene for this pretty rapidly growing space and rapidly trending gift this holiday season. Beyond that, I know I personally have a little device called a Wemo. It's a little thing you put in a plug and you can turn on or off a power outlet from your phone, or you can schedule it to do all kinds of things. I personally love that. I know my dad's got one of those, and it's pretty handy around the house. It's called a Wemo.
Okay. We just got a few minutes left here, but kids today are also a lot more tech savvy than ever before, and some toddlers can even navigate their way through YouTube skipping ads. What are some tech gift possibilities maybe for younger kids?
Well, we've in our gift guide here, again, at chicagotribune.com/bluesky, we've got a little device called the Anki Cosmo. It's a little robot that you can talk to, and it's kind of like a Furby on steroids, perhaps, for those of you that that remember that hot device from the 90s. It's a little robot that it'll play games with you, and it'll learn from you as it hangs out with you. It's kind of an artificially intelligent little guy. It's got little wheels, and it'll interact with you. Apparently, it can even recognize its owner. It also comes with apps, and you can unlock more games as you play. That's a fun little thing. Beyond that, you look at other Nintendo things that have come out. When I was a kid, Super Nintendo and the original Nintendo were a big thing. And that was, again, Nintendo hit the jackpot pretty hard with its miniature Nintendo from last year at the holidays, which sold out lightning fast. Well, this year they came out with an updated version of that, the SNES Mini, the Super Nintendo Mini. And again, they've promised to have a lot more stock on hand for that this year. So if you enjoyed playing with something like that as a kid, you might pass that along to the next generation here, albeit in a smaller version that you can connect over HDMI.
Sure. You know, Ben, there's so many devices that do so many different things. How do you decide what tech gifts we really need and what ones just might end up collecting dust?
Well, need is a difficult word for me, at least, Brian. You know, as much as I love technology and it's my job to sort through it, sometimes it's difficult to parse. I go back to what I was talking about before with the personal assistants in the Wemo. I'm looking for things that make my life easier, and that's really at the heart of it for me. And that's really what I think a lot of the gadgets go to this year. Now, of course, making your life easier may also your mileage may vary as to what you consider to be useful. I think there's a lot of options out there that can really simplify your life these days.
Okay. Would you like to leave our listeners with any particular shopping tips online or in person?
Well, in terms of looking for further gift ideas, we just kind of scratched the surface a little bit of what was in our gift guide. If you're looking for more gift guides and more different types of gifts, the Chicago Tribune has a lot of different gift guides, not just the Blue Sky Tech gifts, but overall at chicagotribune.com/gift guide. But beyond that, it's just interesting to watch how everything increasingly is going online this year. It seems like it's saving a lot of people stressful trips to the mall. It'll be interesting to see how those trends play out. But I know I personally am doing a lot of shopping this year online. If it's not online, though, I'm going to my local stores and patronizing local businesses in my neighborhood up here in Chicago. And I know there's lots of other small businesses that probably have all kinds of other gift guides, tech or not, around your neighborhoods.
Gotcha. And I've got to ask before we go, weirdest or strangest tech products that you've seen being promoted this holiday season?
Weirdest or strangest? Just a couple things that we had in our guides. We had a pillow that plays that'll play music to you over Bluetooth. It's called the Dream Pad. We had a fitness tracker, just like your Apple Watch or your Fitbit type situation, except it's a ring. You wear it around your finger, and it'll track your heart rate and the kinds of things that you do throughout the day. Those are quirky. Going to a sister gift guide that we had on our website, we had in our Broke Millennial gift guide on the Chicago Tribune, we had something called the Milk Tape. Why it's called that, I don't know, but it's essentially a cassette tape that's actually just a USB drive. It looks like a cassette tape, but just to get a little cable hidden on the inside there. So a couple of quirky, fun things that are out there.
And I think we've got time for one more here. Do you have your eye on anything particular, anything from that guide that's on your list for someone to get for you?
Yeah, I know I personally, nothing that I myself want. A lot of these things, that we have a pretty cool, as you mentioned earlier, a backpack that has solar panels on it that you can charge your phone with, or you can charge, it also has an included Bluetooth speaker. Wireless headphones are just so hot these days. You know, whether you look at Apple's AirPods or now Google's got their own, the Google Pixel Buds, those things, as headphone jacks increasingly disappear on phones and headphones, you've got to go wireless. And there's a lot of options out there, whether it's those official things or the Bluetooth headphones, which are increasingly lush and have lots of cool features on them. We had some headphones made by a company called Parrot that are pretty cool. I know I personally have a pair that's a little less expensive, from a brand called Jabra that I love.
Okay, awesome. Great stuff here, Ben. Ben Meyerson is the news editor for Blue Sky Innovation with the Chicago Tribune, and you can, again, find that gift guide at chicagotribune.com. We'll tweet that out for you. Ben, thanks so much for spending some time with us on the 21st today.
Thank you, Brian. My pleasure.
That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. And if you have Alexa, which we talked about today, we're easy to find. Just tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. We're produced by Robin Lynn, Alan Montecelio, and Bob Holly. Libby Foster and Grace Stetson are our interns. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Brian Moline. In for Nyla Boodoo, The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.